You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Hello, welcome to this episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. This episode, I am coming back to longtime favorite Twilight Time with a stack of five of their discs. I would imagine most listeners to this show have checked out some Twilight Time Blu-rays at some point, but if you haven't, they're always one to watch. They are a wonderful company, and I've been a fan for a long time, and they have in no way diminished the quality or cool curation aspect of what they do, and this group of films reflects just that. But I've always felt like I'm pretty well aligned in terms of my taste with most of the stuff that they put out, be it, you know, 70s stuff or classic Hollywood stuff, cult movies. They just run the gamut, and it's a great company. So, without further ado, first one on my stack here is Autofocus from 2002.
Smile. It's a critical time for me. I need something big.
This could be what you're looking for.
This character, Hogan, he's quick on his toes, he's hip, he's a con artist. But I think it's what I've been working toward my whole career.
I am such a fan. I just wonder if
picture together? You betcha. Smile.
Photography's always been my thing. I'm Bob Crane.
John Carpenter. I'm a real gone
lover. If you like photography, you wouldn't believe this new equipment they sent me.
It'll blow your mind.
What will we do with it?
Home movies.
One of my clients is having a party up in the hills on Friday. Could be fun.
Are you seeing another woman?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
What's your secret?
Three words.
Don't make waves.
You're a fortunate man.
Yes, I am.
So the back says, Autofocus is director Paul Schrader's dramatized biography of Bob Crane, Greg Kinnear in a career-making performance, a TV sitcom star of Hogan's Heroes who descended into sexual addiction, obsessed with recording his encounters with scores of women. Willem Dafoe co-stars as John Henry Carpenter, an electronics expert who encouraged and collaborated with Crane. He becomes a prime suspect after Crane is bludgeoned to death in an Arizona motel room. So yeah, this is a really interesting Schrader effort, and I kind of wish he would do more kind of biopics. I mean, it's not exactly that. It's a certain kind of movie in terms of the... It's not exactly a rise and fall, but it kind of is, because he starts as a radio DJ.
As you regular listeners know, from time to time, we have special guests here in the studio. And today, somebody truly special, Mr. Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger, right over here. And I've always wanted to do this with you.
Hi-o, Silver, away!
I never get tired of that. Do people recognize you when you're out in public?
No, not really.
Can we get you to expose yourself today on radio? You take off the mask, reveal your identity?
For you, Bob, sure.
Coming up next, it's a KNX first. We've got the Lone Ranger, and he's naked.
Don't tell Tom.
No, of course not. First up, a word from our sponsor, Lucky Strike Cigarettes.
You know, gets his job on Hogan's Heroes.
You're the hero of the show. It's named after you. And heroes don't try and be heroes. They simply are. Okay. Let's do it again. Same place.
The great disciplinarian knows when to reward and when to punish. Now, my leniency is a legend, right?
Wrong. What do you mean?
You've got a reputation to uphold, Colonel, you know that. I mean, you are running the most brutal prison camp in all of Germany.
I am?
In the world. You're ranked third, right behind Devil's Island and Alcatraz.
Good.
And you're the toughest commandant in Germany.
I am?
In the last war, it was kill the Kaiser. Today, it's kill Klink.
Kill Klink. I like that.
And then things start to go bad. Although, in the commentary, Schrader talks about how the arc is not necessarily accurate in his mind, that he feels that Crane was kind of always that way, and it wasn't that Hollywood made him into a bad person.
This film does have a bit more of a
character arc for Bob than I suspect he actually had. The Jabosi script had a huge character arc for him, which I didn't think was true. You know, I don't think Hollywood makes good people go bad. I think bad people come to Hollywood in order to be bad. And so the idea of good Bob going bad because of Hollywood, that never struck me as true for a second.
But regardless, it's an incredible performance from Greg Kinnear, who I've liked as an actor for a long time, but who I was kind of impressed with in this film in particular, because he has to start in that almost Ned Flanders-y kind of territory and then take it to a much darker place. And I feel like he's really good at the sort of Ned Flanders-y kind of shtick that Bob Crane plays as part of his radio personality and just his general personality in a lot of ways. I guess Kinnear himself was a radio DJ, so like that part of the character and that part of what was going on with Crane in terms of his personality and his persona was something that Kinnear could really understand and emulate. But you never know if somebody can do that and then also go to the dark place and pull it off. And I feel like Kinnear totally does that. He's certainly helped by having Willem Dafoe in the sort of sidekick supporting role of this guy, John Carpenter, who just ended up being an enabler and sort of pushing Crane further down the path of his own obsession. But it's a, you know, it's a dark movie, and it's the kind of movie that you can kind of see why Schrader's drawn to it. He just has some kind of interest in these kind of characters, I guess.
And I came rather quickly to realize that Bob was much like many of my protagonists, in that he was a man who aspired to be one thing, even thought he was one thing, and all the while was acting in a counterproductive behavior, a counterproductive manner. And this, I think more than any other characteristic, has fascinated me. And one way or another, I find myself dealing with that. And because I think that the greatest fun of an artistic enterprise is the exploration of character and of self-destructive behavior in general. It's a subject that never ceases to fascinate me. You know, how, if we want to be happy, why do we do the things, you know, that make us unhappy? And you can never answer those questions, you just sort of explore them. And if you find a character like Bob Crane, who lives this contradiction large, you know, who comes at you with both headlights bright, then it makes it easier to explore.
Anyway, this is a really nice Blu-ray. It's pulling over a lot of stuff from the DVD. This is back before DVD took a real dive and studios would actually spend money on a, quote, special edition release. You know, not a Criterion, but their own special edition. And so it's got a lot of extra features here. Not all of these are ported over, but it has an isolated music track, and then it has three audio commentaries, which is pretty amazing. That's, again, like Criterion-level stuff. In fact, Criterion releases rarely have more than one commentary these days. I would imagine that's due to shrinking budgets and stuff like that, but who knows what the deal is. But anyway, this is great. It's got an audio commentary with director Paul Schrader.
There was a color scheme or a visual scheme employed in this film. It originally came from the production designer, James Chinlin, who referred to Crane's life as an accretion of clutter. And it got messier and messier and more video cables. And we took that idea, which originally was meant only for set design, and applied it across the board. Applied it to production design, color, film stock, camera work, hair, makeup, wardrobe, music. And so that the goal was to gradually make a film that at some point the viewer would realize that he or she is now watching a film entirely different from what they were watching an hour ago. And so this is where we begin. We begin with these pop 60s colors, the saturated film, clean lines, and take it from there. You know, this to me almost looks a little too cartoonish. Yeah, it looks more like an ad for the 50s or 60s than an actual home. But in order to create the shift, you know, we began very kind of bold and bright and uncluttered.
So that's a really good track. I almost always enjoy Paul Schrader commentaries. He's an interesting, thoughtful filmmaker, at least in terms of his process and, you know, where he's coming from creatively. He's just able to articulate it in interesting ways in a commentary track. There is a commentary with actors Greg Kinnear and Willem Dafoe.
Paul will tell you that I have a radio background, a huge radio background, which was so instrumental in this. I hosted a radio show in Athens, Greece, where I grew up as a kid, on Saturdays, once a week for an hour, and basically played records and said a few words. But that was pretty much my background in radio. And he says it was helpful here. I don't know. We were helped a great deal by Julie Weiss. She did the wardrobe and all this, and I love that red sweater. That's all I got to say.
It's a beautiful thing.
Also good. And then maybe my favorite track, although the Schrader track is great, is this final audio commentary with producers Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski and screenwriter Michael Gerbosi.
And so telling the story was difficult to figure out. There's 30 years of story in the book.
Sure.
And originally I had envisioned it as a modern-day investigation into the murder while looking back on the life Bob was leading. And I took, the funny thing is, I took all this time to get this treatment and this and the synopsis together, and then I finally got you guys on the phone.
And then we threw it in the trash.
We can talk about it.
So sort of jump to early 1999, Larry and I get a call one day from our agent saying, there's two people I've never heard of with the rights to a book I've never heard of about a guy I'd never heard of. He says, it's something called The Murder of Bob Crane. Who is Bob Crane? So we start laughing and go, oh my God, that's the most ridiculous thing we've ever heard. And he says, well, you want me to blow them off for you? And we're laughing, saying, you know what, we're impressed with the ambition of these people, whoever they are, to get the rights to a book called The Murder of Bob Crane. You give them the phone number, we'll call them up, and we'll tell them this is not how you break into Hollywood, this is silly.
Bless these guys' hearts, they have literally no interest in this, and they still have lunch with me. That's how great
we felt
they
sorry
are.
For you.
Well, we were impressed that somebody actually would want to make a movie out of the life of Bob Crane. I mean, it's sort of actually gotten us in trouble a lot in our careers that when we get very intrigued by
bad ideas,
if someone says that shouldn't be done, it gets us very, very interested. And when
we're very much like the people we make movies about.
Right. When we heard that you guys were interested in making a movie about the murder of Bob Crane, we're like, that idea is so awful that maybe there's something.
It just
there.
Might work.
Great stuff. Larry and Scott, especially Larry on any track, anything. I just think Larry's the best. He always has interesting stories and is fascinated by this kind of a tale. And yeah, he's just endlessly fascinating. I love listening to him do interviews and podcasts. And anyway, so that's a really great track. Something called Murder in Scottsdale.
The person who stumbled into this was Victoria Berry, who was Bob's co-star in Beginner's Luck. And she'd come to the apartment. He'd given her the blue key, the copy, to the Winfield apartment. There were three blank keys that were used for that, and Bob had one, and she'd gotten one.
She shows up a little earlier than her appointed time, which was 1, I believe, in the afternoon, approximately 1 o'clock. She knocked. There was no answer. She noticed that the morning newspaper was outside the apartment on the stoop there. She picked that up, knocked again. No answer. She tried the knob. The door was unlocked. She pushed it open, and she noted that the interior of the apartment was darkened.
The apartment is totally dark. You cannot really see in the apartment without turning the light on, because Crane had put all these very, very thick drapes up to hide, you know, all the pornography that he had, to hide the photos that he was doing, to hide what he was doing during the day and as night with all the women he was bringing back. So when she opens the door, she goes from the very bright sun of Arizona to the very dark room where Crane's body was found.
There's a making of featurette.
There is this whole notion of sexual addiction, the corrosiveness of celebrity, and the changing of the notion of being an American man at a certain time.
5 deleted scenes with optional commentary from Schrader and original red band and theatrical trailers. So, really solid Blu-ray. The first time, I believe, the film's been on Blu-ray, which is too bad because it's one of Schrader's stronger later efforts. So I'm glad it's finally available. Next up, we move into 70s Copland with the 7-Ups from 1973.
When organized crime becomes so clever that the police are forced to take desperate measures, it becomes hard to tell the cops from the killers.
Quick, Bobby! Bobby, get him!
Roy Scheider, in The French Connection, he helped to crack a $32 million dope ring. Now he's back, leading a new team of undercover super cops, even more ruthless than the mob they're gunning for. The 7-Ups, the dirty trick squad that even the regular police are afraid of.
Who shot the policeman in your car? I'm hurt bad. Who shot your car, Mike?
They bust you. They break you. They make you beg for a nice, safe stretch in prison, 7 years and up.
Who were those guys that shot my partner in the back seat of the car? The guy you iced was a cop.
Okay, so he was a cop.
Now, from the producer of Bullet and The French Connection, a high-speed ride with the strong arm of the law. Their business. It's a matter of kill or be killed. And once the 7-Ups are on your tail, there's only one way to get them off. The producer of Bullet and The French Connection brings you the ultimate chase in the 7-Ups.
The back says, in the mode of The French Connection, The 7-Ups is directed by the former film's producer, Philip D'Antoni, and stars Roy Scheider as the leader of a crack squad of NYPD detectives bent on busting culprits whose offenses guarantee 7 years or up in prison. The cops are nearly as out of line as the crooks, a dangerous bunch of miscreants connected to the mob.
You see the game, Sunday? That guy stepped out of bounds. That ref must have been doing business. Jeez, I went for a shipload of money that day.
Still doing your number, huh?
What's happening?
The Shylock's expanding like National Bank.
Hey, Vito. I told you that.
You told me that?
I told you to find out what kind of muscle he was using and how heavy and who.
No. I was just kidding. It's just that I gotta walk on eggshells around that neighborhood with those wise guys.
What are you worried about? Nobody's gonna find out about us. The only way they're gonna find out is if you tell them, not me, right?
Featuring one of the most famous cinematic car chases ever, designed by the great Bill Hickman, who worked on The French Connection and Bullet. This is a really fantastic, underseen and underappreciated movie. It has gotten a Blu-ray release overseas, which I have, and this is definitely one of my favorite releases of the year because this movie is so strong and because I think more people need to see it. I mean, as well known as The French Connection is, this does very much live in the same world as that, and yet it's woefully underseen. It is really fantastic. It's just gritty. And it does just feel like an extension of that universe in a great way for me. And the car chase is simply outstanding, even to this day. And I certainly have a love for car chases in movies. You know, it's a very cinematic thing to do. And when they used to do it in the 70s and 80s, I hate to be that guy. I'm not always trying to be that guy. But it you really feel it. You really feel the tension of real cars smacking into each other and the camera placed in a very precarious position as to really give you a sense of the speed and the immediacy of the danger. And it's just really well done in this movie. The cast is really strong too. Outside of Roy Scheider, you have Tony LoBianco, Richard Lynch, Bill Hickman, Joe Spinell, just a lot of familiar New York character actor faces that give that great authenticity that I love. So this one's highly recommended. Maybe my pick of the week. Autofocus is obviously a great one, but this also has a lot of special features, which is great. It has an isolated music track of the Don Ellis film score. It has an isolated music track of the unused Johnny Mandel score. It has an audio commentary with film historian Richard Harlan Smith. It has an introduction by director, producer Philip D'Antoni, something called the 7-Ups Connection, something called a Tony LoBianco type, something called Reel to Reel, Cut to the Chase, a featurette, Anatomy of a Chase, behind the scenes of the filming of the 7-Ups.
It's a police drama produced and directed by Philip D'Antoni, who talks about his film.
The two primary characters in the film are played by Roy Scheider and Tony LoBianco. But this featurette is not about them. It's about two other actors. They speak no lines, and they appear in only one major segment of the film. But believe me, they play very important roles. It's their first motion picture, and it's also going to be their last. Because when their work is ended, I guarantee you there won't be enough left of them to work in another picture.
These are the performers, a Pontiac Granville sedan and a Ventura hatchback. And this is the anatomy of a chase. Filming a high-speed car chase through the streets of a busy city is a tricky and highly dangerous thing. Phil D'Antoni knows that better than most filmmakers. He's already done it twice, in San Francisco for Bullet, and here in New York for The French Connection.
This type of thing takes weeks of planning and weeks of shooting. Every maneuver has to be timed to the split second. It's really too big a job for one man, and that's why I brought in the experts. Bill Hickman helped design and execute the chase. I know his work very well because he was also on hand for both Bullet and The French Connection.
Because we have three drivers.
All right.
Plus, I also have another man going to be here in the... Okay. To open that door.
He plays one of the major characters in this film, and he'll be driving the lead car through most of the chase sequences. Jerry Summers is the driver of the chase car. Jerry is just about the best I've ever seen. Whatever he was asked to do, he did it. And we asked him to do some pretty dangerous things, as you'll see later.
Next up is The New Centurions from 1972.
Kilvinsky's law states, treat everybody the same, white, black, brown. Be civil to everyone, courteous to nobody. We're supposed to use equal force, you know?
Right.
Well, rule 2 of Kilvinsky's law is if a dude uses his fist, you use your stick. If he uses a knife, you use your gun. Cancel his ticket right then and there. If everything else fails, hit him with a brick, anything you can get your hands on.
You know, I love it. I really love it in the streets. I don't think I love anything else so much.
I know.
All right, that's it.
Come on, boys, go get him. I got him. I got him.
Kilvinsky's got soul. He get us some scotch and milk. We ask him pretty. You got soul, ain't you, Mr. Kilvinsky?
Baby, I got more soul than I can control.
A cop tells his story in The New Centurion.
The back says, the estimable Richard Fleischer, Fantastic Voyage, The Boston Strangler, directs Sterling Siliphant's adaptation of Joseph Wamba's compulsive bestseller, The New Centurions, focusing on a group of rookie cops who make their way from the LAPD Police Academy to the city's very mean streets. George C. Scott stars as a wise but embittered veteran, along with Stacy Keach, Scott Wilson, Jane Alexander, and Rosalind Cash. Yeah, this is... I like this one a lot. It's pretty downbeat. Again, very gritty. Would play well, perhaps, as a double with the 7-Ups, although there's not as much action in this movie. It's much more character drama. But I'm a big, big fan. I love Stacy Keach, and he and George C. Scott together are pretty perfecto, I must say, for this one.
We're through. We're finished, you know that, don't you?
Hey, come on in. You know better than that.
Anymore. We can't hold the line anymore.
Yeah, but, you know, things change. People change. Last year, everybody's screaming about lack of freedom. This year, they're screaming about lack of control.
Yeah, but something else is happening this time. The don'ts are dying. First, the vice laws die, and then the misdemeanors, and then the felonies. Easy to get rid of crime. All you do is change the laws. No law against selling dope. Dope's not a crime. No law against robbing banks. Bang. Ain't no bank robbers. Fighting crime is getting very easy. Well, let the assholes change the laws and get rid of crime. They can't get rid of evil. Laws change, people don't. Never get rid of evil, never.
You know, it sounds like all these years you've been trying to bust the devil.
The public don't understand. Lawyers, judges don't understand. They only see the criminals. We see the victims. We know what crime does to people because we see them like nobody else does.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe you can change people, but you can help them. Maybe not much. Maybe it's a losing battle. Maybe they don't like us. But I think they need us. I think they always have. I mean, even the Romans had centurions to keep the peace. And they were unsupported, unhonored, disliked, just like us. But they held the line for a while, until Rome was finally overrun by barbarians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, here's to the new centurions. Let's hope they do a better job than the old ones.
And the supporting cast, you know, Scott Wilson, I'm a huge, huge Scott Wilson fan. He's excellent in this.
Dr. Taylor, Dr. David Taylor.
Andy, have you ever been shot?
No, not even nicked.
I wonder if I could take it.
What?
What Roy's going through. They say a stomach wound's the most painful of anything.
Well, if it hurts, it hurts, whether you can take it or not.
Dr. Brown, Dr. Ross Brown.
Yeah. Except somebody fired point blank at him and almost cut him in two. It's like dying without dying. Roy's got to be different now. Doesn't he?
Yes, I suppose he does at that.
Rosalind Cash, I know from The Omega Man, and I like her a lot. But you've got other people like Clifton James, great character actor, Carol Speed, James B. Sicking, who I think I'll always remember as the dad on Doogie Howser. But yeah, there's a lot of other folks you might recognize, like, say, Eric Estrada is also in this movie, which is pretty great. So on top of that, it's directed by Richard Fleischer, who I'm a big fan of, who made just a ton of movies, from Violent Saturday to The Vikings to Compulsion to Crack in the Mirror, 10 Rillington Place. That's another one that Twilight Time put out. Great, dark, dark thriller. The Last Run, See No Evil, right before The New Centurions. And then right after The New Centurions, he did Soylent Green, just kind of a classic, as cheesy as it is. Mr. Majestic, Mandingo, Conan the Destroyer, Red Sonja. I mean, he's got quite the lengthy and varied filmography. But yeah, I'm a big fan of this. And if you're into sort of that 70s cop drama, kind of just the way it was done back then, things like The Laughing Policeman.
The Laughing Policeman is never amused. He's rarely surprised, and nothing ever shocks him. But this time, they've gone too far.
What the hell is this? Some kind of a freaky game?
Shake up the town. See if it makes any noise.
I'm interested in a piece of hardware, like a grease gun.
Looking for a man named Bobby Moe.
What's going down on that bus thing, man?
The most bizarre investigation in the history of San Francisco.
Looks like a bad one. Let's get his clothes off.
The more they find out, the less they want to know.
Did your roommate go out with a lot of men?
She didn't go out with men at all.
Hey, I'm going to tell you something. Don't ever pick up stuff off my desk again. Got it?
Did you ever see this man before?
Yes.
Rodney.
You mean Rodney?
As Chris said, Rodney.
We're looking for a dude named Rodney Davis.
Whatever you're reaching for better be a sandwich, because you're going to have to eat it.
That's probably a better double for this, although ultimately kind of a depressing double feature. But yeah, I like that movie a lot, and I like this movie a lot. The special features include isolated music track, audio commentary with actor Scott Wilson and film historian Nick Redman, audio commentary with film historians Lee Pfeiffer and Paul Scrabo. Both great. Both great tracks. Really cool. Again, Scott Wilson, something about that guy. He's like a Warren Oates type to me, you know, he just fits that mold perfectly. Yeah, he's great. Okay, so next up, we pay a visit to our buddy Sam Fuller with Underworld USA from 1961.
Everyone knows what this is. But few of us know what throbs underneath. And I know. I wrote the story of Underworld USA. My name is Sam Fuller, and in order to back up my story, I had to get facts. Well, I dug deep. And I got the facts. Facts that uncovered a world of vice and crime. And that's why Underworld USA has to be seen. Because this world, with all its quiet brutality, is a threat. It's a threat to everyone, everywhere.
I told you once we had a national setup, we could form a government of our own inside the USA. And we did. But we won't stay big if we lose our grip.
The guns of gangland speak and tell the story of today's march of crime. Excitement that rips through the curtain of organized vice. The labor rackets, gambling, drug traffic, and the big bosses who govern this empire of evil.
There they are. That's my job. Now, those are the three punks I'm going to get.
Punks? You call them punks? Why, they're better guarded than the President of the United States. And you're going to get them?
Here, too, is the story of people caught between the law and the lawless.
Call him and tell him I'll pick it up and I'll deliver it. Call him and tell him.
Living as though every minute could be their last.
Some women, when they kiss, blush. Some swear, some bite, some laugh, some cry. Me, I die.
The back says, the great American auteur Samuel Fuller gives us, in Underworld USA, a terrifyingly prescient look at a nation on the surface serene and at peace, in which organized crime and big business have somehow merged. All this is seen through the eyes of a young man, Cliff Robertson, bent on avenging the death of his father at the hands of punks who turn out to be ubiquitous and working on both sides of the law. Also starring Dolores Dorn, Beatrice Kay, and Richard Rust, and memorably shot by the great Hal Moore, who also shot Rancho Notorious and The Wild One. Yeah, this is a pretty great, classic, fully Sam Fuller kind of Sam Fuller movie. You know, it just has the... I mean, all of his films, especially in this period, have that, again, auteuristic stamp of the dialogue and the situations, and using that word grittiness again.
It's okay with him, Gus. Take care of the transfer.
Oh, Mr. Gila. I'm sorry I called you away from your meeting.
For 50 grand, you didn't have to bother me.
Mr. Gila. Oh, I didn't know that package belonged to you.
Sure, now you know.
Yeah. Now I know when the deal is off.
Now, don't push your luck.
I may be a sentimental meathead. But this time... this package on the house.
On the house? Why on the house?
Tom Devlin.
Who?
Tom Devlin. He was my father. I'm Dolly Devlin.
Devlin, huh? Devlin. Yeah.
You used to work with him in the 30s, right?
No, I know why you look so familiar. Yeah. I used to work with him.
You and him was like brothers till my old man got bumped off.
Who told you we were like brothers?
Vic Farrar. I met him in a prison hospital.
Yeah. He's from the old days, too.
Mr. Gila, you know them four gunsels that bumped my father off?
Yeah?
They got paid off. Burned to death in a car wreck.
Who told you that?
Vic. Died in my arms in a hospital. I ain't taking no package from you.
You trying to tell me that you're dumping 50 grand just because of sentiment?
It would be like tapping my own father.
but it's heightened in this way that I feel like Fuller sort of has uniquely mastered. You know, he just, there's something about the worlds he creates. You can see why Tarantino is such a fan, and how Tarantino kind of does the same thing with his dialogue and with the situations and characters, that he just makes a Tarantino movie in the Tarantino universe. Sam Fuller has also always done that, and I really do love that about him, and I see why other people respond to that. So yeah, this is one for the Sam Fuller canon. Very solid stuff.
I once saw a movie like that, all about revenge. Ex-con's revenge. Very touching. Close to home, huh? Only he was smart. Not like you. You're not smart. You know why you're not smart, Tolly? Because the day's gonna come when you want out. And the only way you're gonna get off their payroll is on a nice, big, cold marble slab. You know how I know? Because I got one waiting for me. Yeah. You think Gus was gonna polish me off just because I didn't pick up that package? Uh-uh. Oh, I know too much. I know names and things. Like, for instance, I saw Mr. Smith kill a dame. She was a hustler.
Who was the broad?
Yeah, Tolly, I saw too much. And that old Gus, you would have killed me if it hadn't been for you. Sandy told me all about your old man, how he was a nothing, a real nothing. But to you, he was like a god. You must have an awful lot of love in you.
Yeah, the dialogue is just something else. It's, I don't know, it just makes me smile every time I watch a Sam Fuller movie. I'm just like, damn it, you did it again. You wonderful man. So anyway, great disc. I'm glad to see yet another Sam Fuller movie coming out from Twilight Time. They've done a bunch so far. This one features an isolated music track, a featurette called Sam Fuller Storyteller, a short one called Martin Scorsese on Underworld USA.
You know, very often people describe a picture, it's going to be this way and that way, and then I'm going to do this, and then he walks in, she does this. And when it translates to screen, something seems to be missing. But he talked it, and he proved it.
I hear him say to this punk that if he thought he could get a short sentence, he'd make a deal with you as long as nobody knew he did the singing.
Gita said that?
That's what I heard him say.
He worked so much in tabloids, didn't he? He worked so much in the 20s and 30s, right? And in a way, some say that he was always a pulp artist, but at this point in his career, his pictures were getting so, in a sense, everything extraneous was cut away. They were blunt and direct and forceful. It's the style of the film that you really remember. I mean, almost every shot hits you like a punch. I think it has to do with the composition, the camera movement, but also the rhythm of the cutting, a kind of jarring kind of cutting, and basic elemental nature of the story, because the character played by Cliff Robinson, he's defined by his vengeance. It's behind every move he makes. And Fuller was always jarring the viewers to attention with, you know, clashes of images, sounds, emotions. I mean, there are so many images and cuts and gestures of the actors and moves from this particular film that have stayed with me over the years and affected my own movies.
Great movie, well worth a pickup. Last on my pile is a movie called Don't Bother to Knock from 1952.
I'm the guy in 821 across the court. Can I ask you a question?
Well, I don't know. I suppose so. Are you sure you want me?
Yeah, you're the one I want, all right. You doing anything you couldn't be doing better with somebody else?
If you want.
Does that mean come on over?
When I stepped into that room, I ran smack into an adventure you don't forget in a long time. Because the screen has never shown this kind of woman before. The kind that reaches out in the loneliness of the night to a stranger passing by. I should have seen the warning of danger in her eyes. But what happened in that suspense-filled night was about to change my entire life. Why didn't you tell me you were working here?
I'm not. I'm just doing it for tonight.
Yeah, I know. You're an heiress. Tomorrow morning, you ride through your estate, side saddle.
She made you say that.
I believe in a drink, a kiss, and a laugh now and then.
I still like to laugh. But not at myself.
What do you want? Hearts and flowers forever and ever? Love?
Don't be afraid to say it. It's not a dirty word.
I can't figure you out. You're silk on one side and sandpaper on the other.
I'll be any way you want me to be.
Why? Why is it so important?
Because I belong with you.
Don't Bother to Knock stars Marilyn Monroe in an early dramatic role, eerily playing a demented babysitter drawn to a man, played by Richard Widmark. She ultimately becomes convinced is her dead lover. Anne Bancroft is also on hand, making her screen debut as Widmark's chanteuse girlfriend, hoping against hope that he'll prove himself worthy. Shot handsomely by the great Lucian Ballard. Yeah, this is a really neat little, I think, kind of underseen noir, directed by Roy Ward Baker. I am not one to necessarily rush to Marilyn Monroe's defense as an actress, although, again, as I might have stated before, with certain bigger-than-life stars, I always appreciate their place in film history. But she definitely had her moments, though, and I feel like this is easily, for me, one of my favorite performances from her, and it's so weird that it's not the typical thing that she sort of got slotted into later in her career. So it's a little unfortunate. She has range, and she shows range, but sometimes at the outer edges, the beginnings and the end films in her career were the ones where you got to see it a little bit more, I think. But I love Richard Widmark, and it's really neat to see them play a scene together for sure. I found this clip of director Roy Ward Baker talking about directing Marilyn Monroe in this film, which I thought was interesting.
Marilyn's stage fright was so intense, she would vomit before coming onto the set and cower in her dressing room, keeping co-stars Anne Bancroft and Richard Widmark waiting.
I didn't like it, but professionally, if something collapses or goes wrong or somebody's ill or whatever, and then somebody else has to step in, and so I did. One of the most important things you have to do is to support the supporting cast. Wherever you're dealing with a star, the same thing applies the other way around. You have to support the star vis-a-vis the supporting cast, because all of them have to be carefully nurtured according to their position in the story. It was a part that she could get her teeth into, almost literally, and she did. She had a wonderful performance. It was theatrical, nearly quite over the top.
So, you know, a neat little noir thingy that is definitely worth your time, you know, if you're a Widmark fan like me, or if you're into seeing the lesser seen side of Marilyn Monroe. But there's also some other great supporting characters here, like Alicia Cook Jr., Jim Backus, the aforementioned Anne Bancroft. So that always helps elevate a movie for me. In fact, Alicia Cook Jr., he's one of those guys, gives a little bump to every movie I've ever seen him in. I absolutely love him. Special features on this disc include an isolated music track, something called Marilyn Monroe, the Mortal Goddess.
She did behave badly. She was unprofessional at times. She could be incredibly difficult.
What we saw with Marilyn Monroe was the tragedy and the vulnerability.
Wait a minute!
She was a carefully crafted show business creation, an alluring blend of sex and sensitivity. But more than three decades after her untimely death, Marilyn Monroe has come to represent more than just a Hollywood actress. She has become an icon, an immortal symbol of glamour and sensuality. Hers is the legend of a great star who burned brightly, but all too briefly.
She used to say, I don't want to be rich, I just want to be loved. She represented those two strongest of human emotions, which are hope and fear.
And Richard Widmark, strength of characters, both as seen on Biography on the A&E Network. Those are very cool. I like the Biography A&E approach. You know, it's pretty straightforward, but I like both these actors, and so a little peek behind the curtain is quite welcome and a nice little extra added bonus. So that's it for this Twilight Time-centric fiver. Hope you enjoyed it. Go check out their website. Check out screenarchives.com, where they have sales from time to time and where you can get deals on pre-ordering the whole group of titles they put out in a given month. I think it's you get $5 off every title if you get all four or five that they put out. And that's a special that they do with pre-orders at Screen Archives before those films come out in a given month. But anyway, love the company, love these discs, check them out. Have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week, and I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.